Welcome back to Current State for the Monday of a truncated work week for many people. We hope you've got a chance to disconnect a little bit this week, at least in a couple of days, if you're not lucky enough to have the whole week off. Current State will be here every day. Coming up, WKAR-TV airs the documentary Detropia tonight. That is destination viewing if you are interested in all that ails the Motor City. And here on Current State in a little bit, we'll talk with a co-producer and co-director of Detropia and another view of Ty Cobb, speaking of Detroit, a more humane assessment of the Tiger legend from his grandson. It's an interesting encounter that I had with Herschel Cobb Jr., and that is coming up here on Current State in just a little bit. We're glad you're back for Monday. Michigan State University researchers are getting attention with a proposed remedy for urban blight, one with particular relevance for the capital city. For some years, the city of Lansing and Lansing Township have struggled with abandoned auto plants. According to this MSU report, there are 135 abandoned car plants nationwide. Casualties of America's manufacturing slump and the Great Recession, often they include acres of asphalt and polluted land that become unproductive eyesores and are difficult to repurpose. Now, this report from MSU's Center for Community and Economic Development recommends mandatory insurance for automakers and other manufacturers to cover the costs of tearing down unused factories and buildings. And joining us to share more is the lead author of the report, Dr. Rex Lamore. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me on.
A pleasure. Talk to us about the origin of this study. Did it start out as an open-ended exploration of how to address blighted industrial property, or did you start out with the insurance idea and explore the ramifications of that?
Well, actually, the idea came to me. I happen to be a member of a local planning commission here in the mid-Michigan area, and we were considering the construction of a cell tower in our community. And under Michigan planning law, local communities can require cell tower companies to place a bond on those towers. So at the life of that cell tower, that tower is deconstructed, so it's not likely to fall over and present a health and safety hazard to others in the community. And it occurred to me that couldn't we apply the same principle to other industrial and commercial properties that also present a health and safety hazard in the community? So really, we began our research with my colleague Michelle LeBlanc looking at a bonding request. And as we got into this and looked at the complexities of it, we felt that it probably would be better handled by a private sector insurance sector that would be able to both assess the current uses and nature of the structure and develop a premium structure that would be more accurate of the true cost of deconstruction at the end of the facility's useful life. So we actually started out with bonding as a major focus, but moved to insurance as a secondary focus.
Now, you and your team do recommend mandatory insurance for newly built manufacturing facilities. Did you look into the costs involved? How much would that add to startup costs for somebody launching an endeavor like this?
Yep, two questions. Mandatory, yes, because we felt that it would be important that it be applied ubiquitous across state and national levels so we don't find this bidding war going on with local communities saying, well, I'm willing to accept abandonment in 50 years if you'll move your business to our community. So something at a national level, so ubiquitous in terms of its coverage. And then in terms of the cost elements, and this is where the complexities enter, it depends on the nature of the construction of the facility, how the building is built, and we think there will be some future effects if this policy is adopted on how private sector industry builds buildings, so they're just deconstructible, as you might say, and the use of the facility over the life of the facility, so that cost would rise if the use is likely to lead to contamination, so that at the end point of that building's life, if there's likely to be contamination, the cost of deconstruction would increase. So there's going to be quite a bit of variability in terms of cost of this policy. Now, we've done some quick numbers, and these are obviously very rough estimates. If you use a base of approximately $57,000 per acre of cleanup on a contaminated industrial site, now that's your worst scenario, you figure that and most commercial sites are not an acre in size, but some industrial sites are much larger than that. Then over a 30 to 50 year period, you know, you're looking at approximately, and this varies again on the use and the nature of construction, $100 to $200 to $250 a month, $40 to $60 a week that might be added on to the cost of business. Now, here's the people are going to say, hey, it's going to cost business to increase, right? Yeah. They're going to pass it on to their consumers. That's what business does. But they can plan for this increased cost. They'll build it into their business planning. That cost will be distributed to the consumer of that good, which we think is a positive effect because the way that we do cleanup now of abandoned facilities, the cost of cleanup is distributed across the population as opposed to just those individuals or businesses that consume that good. We think this is a more true cost accounting, fair cost accounting method. So the people that consume that service pay for the cleanup of that site at the end of the life of that facility.
I am wondering, though, how industry, the chemical industry, let's say, or I mean the manufacturers that really deal with a lot of toxic chemicals, I imagine $57,000 an acre might be a bargain to clean up a site that's really been polluted.
Yeah, and this is an average based on current information. Again, this information is very sketchy. And even the number of abandoned parcels, industrial and commercial parcels nationwide, is very sketchy. And one of the things that we think may occur if this policy is adopted is that the behavior of industry will adjust to this. If you can imagine the insurance companies that will be developing these policies, monitoring the behavior of a company in such that they're are likely to employ the best practices that might be regarding the treatment of hazardous materials.
That could push their premiums down, too, I would
exactly.
imagine. That could be built into the policy.
That's right? Exactly right. The insurance companies would encourage these industries to do the best so that they're less likely to end up with a expensive cleanup at the end of the life of that particular facility. And so we think that this kind of private sector self-policing, or the insurance company would be monitoring the commercial and industrial user, is likely to result in, again, the kind of behavior that I think most folks are interested in, this good environmental conscious behavior.
I imagine some pretty powerful forces would line up against, though, this as a potential job killer. The manufacturing sector, economic developers, I mean, communities desperate for jobs. Has anyone from the manufacturing sector responded to the idea?
Not yet. We've vetted this through a few focus groups, and in general, we've found interest. Though we haven't seen strong resistance to date, but I think the idea is just now beginning to be considered. We hope that think of the cost structure that this is likely to result in. For some industries, this may be a way of reducing tax and costs because they're not the polluting industries. Their behavior is positive, so they might actually see a reduction as a result of it, whereas other industries that are what you might call more polluting and higher risk industries might see an increase. And again, that'll all be passed on to the consumers. We think that individuals who are committed to the concepts of public health and safety, because abandonment, which leads to blight, is a public health and safety concern. The Constitution requires elected officials who swear an oath to uphold the Constitution to protect the public health and safety. This is a clear public health and safety issue. So we feel that when folks have an opportunity to discuss this concept and begin to give critical consideration to it, that they'll see that this is probably in the benefit of the public's health and safety, and hopefully will move accordingly.
We're talking with Dr. Rex Lamore of Michigan State University's Center for Community and Economic Development about his recommendation, or a report that recommends mandatory insurance for new manufacturing initiatives. Did you involve sites in Lansing in your report in any way? We obviously contend with this in Lansing.
Right, and as do communities throughout the industrial Midwest. The legacy cities of the Midwest have these sites throughout them. No, we did not involve them in the development of this concept.
Okay. And part of what you anticipate here, as you said, is the creation of a new private sector industry related to this. Go a little deeper with us on that.
Yes, we believe that if this policy were adopted, that one again, we'll see the probability that in the construction of new industrial and commercial facilities, they will employ different construction techniques, deconstruction techniques. The assembly of buildings will be done in a way that they can be disassembled and separated more easily and quickly. And so we'll see that sort of deconstruction industry grow. And on the other end, at the end of the life cycle of these buildings, we'll see the recycling, and which right now is pretty much an underground economy. We're seeing it occur in many of our abandoned, blighted neighborhoods. The individuals are deconstructing the buildings in part now by ripping out the valuable materials. Under this policy, all the materials would be coming out. You know, the habitat reuse facilities will see a growth in that sector. And so we believe both the insurance sector will grow, because this will grow a particular skill set within the insurance sector on how to cost and value these types of activities, and then also within the deconstruction sector, which tends to involve both everything from engineering to labor type of activities, construction activities. So we think that that sector will grow as well.
We've got less than a minute here, Rex. Do you think Michigan's history as a manufacturing state means your report will be taken more seriously or less seriously?
Well, I think the citizens of Michigan clearly understand the nature of abandonment and blight. I mean, we see it in every corner of our state. The strip mall in your neighborhood now is likely to be your abandoned strip mall in 20 to 30 years. So I think the people of Michigan certainly know the price of abandonment, both in terms of their property values. So I think the people of Michigan are very motivated to look at ways to end this plague and the abandonment cycle that we have in place now. So I think the people of Michigan will take it seriously and hopefully provide leadership nationwide in the adoption of something like this.
Dr. Rex Lamore is with MSU's Center for Community and Economic Development. We've been talking about his proposal for mandatory insurance for manufacturers. Thanks, Rex.
Thank you, Mark.
This week marks the 150th anniversary of the turning point of the U.S. Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg. During this week, in 1863, General Robert E. Lee's all-out attempt to invade the North was turned back by the Union's Army of the Potomac, led by General George Meade. The battle ended with more than 50,000 killed and wounded. Michigan men suffered 40% casualties. Gettysburg sent the South on the road to its 1865 surrender. This week, WKAR presents a three-part series remembering the Battle of Gettysburg and Michigan's role in the war between the states. Here in Part 1, WKAR's Peter Wharf joins MSU history professor Roger Rosentrater at the MSU Museum to view and discuss the exhibit, Michigan in the Civil War. Their discussion begins with the role Michigan soldiers played in the conflict.
Michigan has had a lot of cavalrymen, per capita more cavalrymen than any other northern state. And this particular weapon, the Sharps, or some of the other carbines that were out there, allowed, Spencer is another carbine they've got on display, it allowed them greater firepower.
Why was it that Michigan had a larger percentage of cavalrymen?
You know, that's a great question. Maybe we didn't like to walk as much. I'm not exactly sure why we had more, but it may have been. At the outset of the war, the federal government didn't want volunteer cavalrymen. They said there's no way you can train or outfit a cavalryman as a volunteer. And again, the war was going to be short, and we weren't going to need to go through this very intense process of training cavalrymen. Obviously, that changes. And part of Michigan's situation may have been certain folks back home who took the initiative. There was a congressman from Grand Rapids by the name of Kellogg, for example, who worked very hard, got permission from the War Department, organized several regiments of cavalry. And four of them would ultimately be formed into a brigade. That was a rarity to have four from the same state. And they would fight in the Eastern Theater, most prominently at the Battle of Gettysburg, under the command of a new brigadier general by the name of George Custer. So, again, firepower, the ability to move, and horses clearly allow them to move, but what they did in the Civil War a lot wasn't these grandiose cavalry fights with swords. There are swords on display here as well. It was generally you take your cavalrymen and you got them to a location. Three men would allow their horses to be held by a fourth man, while those three use their additional firepower, like you've got here in a Spencer or a various carbines, and you've got the ability to move. That was the whole idea. You could get to a particular place fairly quickly, and then you've got additional firepower. And that works to their advantage by mid-war, and then clearly a distinct advantage as we move into the latter part of the war. The South suffering from a loss of horses, for example, not as able to replace them as the North was able to. Here's another artifact here, Harris Hillard's 3rd Cavalry Decorative Box. The reason I noticed it here is it talks about at the end of the war, because what happens, getting back to Michigan cavalrymen, is when the war is over, as was normally the case, you know, the Southerners go home to the destruction that's been left behind. Well, Northerners said, we won the war, we want to come home. And most of them did come home. There were some exceptions, though. One group of exceptions was the Michigan Cavalry Brigade, because they were sent west to deal with what was then perceived as an Indian problem, right? And we need veteran, skilled cavalrymen. So you can imagine these guys, they'd just gone through the Grand March in late May of 1865 in Washington, and they're going home, or so they think. And as they make that train trip, when they get to St. Louis, Missouri, and the train's not turning north, and no one's told them, by the way, you know, we're just getting on the train, boys. So they finally end up in the Dakota Territories, and they spent about the next 6 to 9 months out west, taking casualties and doing a part of what they were supposed to do, which was to protect settlers from the Indian threat, or the perceived Indian threat, as it were. Then to show you the gratitude the government had when they finally mustered them out, they said, "All right, you guys can go home now. Good luck." And they didn't make provision for them to come home, so they ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and they had to fortunately the Michigan congressional delegation was able to find some money and bring them home. Otherwise, they'd probably still be there, or maybe they would have settled in Utah for all I know. But I thought it was a little bit unfair to say, you know, we're going to make you stay in. I mean, they were in the Army. They had to stay. I mean, they couldn't just go home. They certainly were not excited at all. They had joined up to fight the Confederates, not to fight the Sioux.
That's an amazing story that probably not many people know, that these were soldiers who thought the war was over. They were put on a train, assuming they were on their way home, and then they were taken out west to fight Indians.
Yeah. And again, it was quite a shock, I'm sure, to them to suddenly say, okay. And they were fairly disgruntled, as you might imagine. Matter of fact, there are a number of instances of guys deserting. I mean, as soon as a boat stopped somewhere, and they had already been told at this point, they immediately got, and they in some cases they were not allowed off the boat, you know, because they went up the Missouri River. That's where the boat comes into, and they say, well, we're not letting guys off, because in the previous stops, whenever we get off, people don't come back.
Yeah. So, Roger Rosentrater's history professor at Michigan State University. We're touring the exhibit today, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary at the Michigan State University Museum. Can we step over here to something that might be very familiar to people who are interested in the Civil War? It's one of the smallest items in the display and in any Civil War display, but probably has one of the greatest impacts throughout the war and throughout the history of war.
Right. Well, you're looking at a mini ball, and it was named after its French inventor, Claude Monet. Now, we can't say Monet as Americans, so we had to call it mini, but it is the .58 caliber cartridge that was used in your basic Civil War musket. And there is a cartridge, a paper cartridge below that, which shows you, and if you were to open that, there would be black powder in there as well as that particular bullet. So if you take the Springfield, which is up here on display, there is a ramrod, and what you have to do is go through a 9-step process to load this thing. and we can't do it on the radio, but nevertheless, you have to take the cartridge, you got to tear the cartridge, you got to put the powder in, you got to ram the powder, put the bullet in, ram the bullet in, then you have to put the ramrod back because you're going to need it again, right? Then you have to put a cartridge, a percussion cap, as it were, near the base of the rifle, and then you're ready to fire. I mean, and it's, if you're really good, you are supposed to be able to do this 3 times a minute. It's pretty mind-boggling, I think, when I think about the process involved.
I can't imagine doing that fast while on a battlefield with guys shooting at me.
No, and that's a very good point. You know, people are shooting at you, and there's a very interesting scene in the movie Glory, which some of the listeners would have certainly have seen, where one of the young recruits is firing away, and suddenly the officer, Matthew Broderick, comes up and...
Attention, company! As you were. You're a good shot, Private.
Thank you, sir. Squirrel hunting.
You ever killed a man?
No, sir.
But you're handy with a gun.
Yes, sir.
Reload. Faster! Faster! Discharge your weapon. Do it! Now do it again, only this time, I want it done quickly. Faster! Reload. Faster!
And he's firing the pistol in his ear because he's saying, hey, this is the distraction you have to deal with.
And he's saying faster and faster while shooting in the soldier's ear.
You know, as opposed to, oh, yeah, I'm just kind of shooting bottles or whatever. Now, the range of this particular bullet, because it's rifled, the barrel of the rifle is got grooves in it. And that allows this bullet to travel accurately about 400 to 500 yards. Why that's important is that the tactics haven't kept up with the weaponry. And if you can start, as I explained to my students, if you can start hitting people at 3 or 4 football fields and you're marching, not necessarily running, even if you're loading slowly, you can do a pretty good job and a lot of damage.
The tactics were based on older methods that weren't taking into account a more accurate weapon.
Well, a smoothbore musket has a range of maybe 100 yards. So think 1 football field. So if I can still, and it still gets loaded somewhat similarly, so if I can load it once, crossing 100 yards, or again, as I tell my students, how quickly can you run that 100-yard dash? Now, they didn't run a lot in the Civil War. They marched because having that massed firepower was very important. But you can still cover 100 yards fairly quickly. And again, if you've got bayonets and there's a lot of you, you're going to intimidate the guy at the other end, even if he's got the first shot off. But at 4 or 5 football fields, that's a whole different process.
He's still far away.
He is. And again, that's a long distance to try to travel, and you can get several rounds off. And again, if the idea is massing, I mean, bringing together literally hundreds, if not thousands, of rifles at one time, and then firing fairly routinely, again, covering that terrain is almost impossible. If you think about the Battle of Fredericksburg, for example, the Yankees covered about a 500 to 600-yard open field. The Confederates were at the top behind a stone wall. There were several thousands of them at that stone wall so that someone could load and hand a weapon so they didn't have to even load themselves if they were in the front rank. But the point being is that after 14 continuous charges, the Yankees never got any closer than 40 yards.
Roger Rosentrater is history professor at Michigan State University. We've been looking at the exhibit, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. Professor Rosentrater, thanks very much.
All right, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Coming up on Current State, a different view of Tiger legend Ty Cobb from his grandson. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. Stay with us. Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Baseball legend Ty Cobb of the Detroit Tigers was the first player elected to the Hall of Fame. He played in Detroit from 1905 to 1926 and then 2 more seasons in Philadelphia. His career batting average of .367 produced 4,191 hits and 12 batting titles. Cobb had a well-documented reputation as a tenacious competitor as well for being just a nasty man, hot-tempered and a man who hated, in the words of ESPN's Larry Schwartz, Northerners, Catholics, blacks, and apparently anybody else who was different from him. Ty Cobb was a terrible father, too, when his son Herschel became a violent drunk. Now, Ty Cobb's grandson, Herschel Cobb Jr., has written a book about his grandfather that shows a different side of the Georgia peach, that of a man who recognized his shortcomings in time to become a doting, affectionate, and protective grandfather. It's called Heart of a Tiger, Growing Up with My Grandfather Ty Cobb. In a phone interview from his home in California, Herschel Cobb says he saw another side to his grandfather.
He was caring, he was protective, he had wisdom. He was a very, very confident fellow. He was not a braggart or a boaster when I was around him. And altogether, I enjoyed spending a lot of time with him. So it kind of emanated out of that direction.
In an interview about retiring from the game, your granddad, Ty Cobb, seemed gracious to fans while looking forward to spending time away from people and more time, notably, with a dog, who he refers to in this soundbite at his retirement. Let's listen.
This old friend of mine, Gear, he's a dog, it's true, but he's a great friend. Now, he won't boo me, and he won't criticize me. But I do want to say this. I'm not finding any fault with the fans or anyone, because I feel deeply obligated to everyone for all the kindnesses and all the nice things they've done and they've said about me in my career as a ball player.
So is that remark more indicative of the Ty Cobb that you knew?
Well, that's the first time I've ever heard that. I know that he had a great fondness for his hunting dogs, and I also know that he had a great respect for the fans and actually many, many teammates. You know, in the course of putting together my book, I was asked many, many questions by many people. You know, if you're an author, you look around for an agent who will take on a project and say, oh, I think you have something here. During the course of this, you know, now we have access to the internet. You can find out what contemporaries actually think of their fellow ball players. And I was fortunate enough to chance upon an entire section of quotes from other ballplayers regarding Ty Cobb, his ferocity on the base paths and on the field, but his gentlemanly acts and manner off of the field, repeated by dozens of contemporaries. I mean, you have Babe Ruth and George Sisler and Honus Wagner, and the list goes on and on. And I think all those fellows were very respectful of each other's skills. I know that my grandfather had a great respect for Babe Ruth. He had a great respect for Tris Speaker, and spent a lot of time with Mr. Speaker. I actually thought Mr. Speaker was the best center fielder of all time and was a great ball player. So in many ways, his expression of gratitude to the fans and other players is very genuine. And all of his life, you know, he loved baseball. That was his life. He played competitively and intensely for 24 years. I did not see him play. I did not learn of the extent of his exploits until I was 12 and a half, going on 13, and even then it was not direct description. It was more a series of actions in his study, answering the mail of fans asking for an autographed baseball or an action picture and seeing his response, which was very generous. I don't think anybody that I've ever met who asked him for an autograph was ever refused. In fact, I will tell you, you know, I live in Menlo Park, California, which is near Atherton, where Ty Cobb's house is. And an old fellow came up to me and he says, Herschel, I want to talk to you. I haven't seen you in ages. And I said, okay, what is it? He says, I just remembered last month I was out and I wanted an autographed baseball, or I wanted an autograph of Ty Cobb. So I took a napkin over to his table. I saw him at a restaurant. And he took my hand, and we got into his car, and we drove to his house over on Spencer Lane. He took me inside, and he grabbed one of the baseballs out of his big barrel, and he autographed it to me and dated it and handed it to me and said to me, will this do? This guy was so happy to relate that story. But that was more typical of the grandfather Ty Cobb that I knew.
In your book, you describe both of your parents as heavy drinkers. You write that you feared your father's explosive temper. What do you make of your granddad's apparent attempts to shield you from your dad?
Well, you know, I think that my grandfather sensed the element in my father that had the term bully in it. Nowadays, there's a very, very low threshold. And in those days, you know, I lived through it. I had a lot to deal with growing up with respect to having friends who were guys and trusting them. I had a lot to deal with growing up and having friends who were females and trusting them. But I think that my grandfather was estranged from both of his sons that died early. My father died when he was 33, and my Uncle Ty died when he was 42. And I think it was the same qualities of intensity and fierce competitiveness that propelled him to the top of baseball that created that schism with his sons. And I think that that had ramifications, that by the time that my dad was 30 and 31 and 32, Ty Cobb couldn't do anything about. And I think it made him sad, and I think that he saw that his grandchildren were going to suffer. But there again, he's Southern, and Southern people don't interfere in the parenting of other people's children. So long as my mother was involved, my father was involved, my grandfather wasn't going to take it upon himself to interfere to a great extent unless the opportunity arose. It did arise when we went hunting on the Snake River in 1949. I was very, very thankful because that whole incident scared me deeply, as perhaps it would with any young man who sees their father so intimidating and so bullying.
What do you feel you lost when your granddad died?
Well, that was a lot. He was a neat guy to be around. He was a great grandfather to be around. You know, a guy who could laugh out loud, make fun of himself. And he had the confidence and the wherewithal to make a difference in what he set his mind to. You know, it's some of the stories in the book are light and funny, but they were there intentionally to portray to my children that they had a great grandfather who had a sense of humor, a sense of teasing, but a sense of, like, he's not going to tease hard enough so that if you don't get the joke, you're going to suffer. No, you know, you were taken care of, and he knew how to make fun of himself. I lost a protector. I lost a confidant. I lost somebody that you could go someplace with, and he always had a straight back and held his head high, and he was always there with a big fist, and he was always there with a hand on my shoulder, or when I was a little kid, you know, it was hanging down, I could grab a hold of it, and know that fellow I could trust, and I think that was the main thing that I felt that I lost. But I built upon it. I built upon what time I had with him to construct something different in my own life.
How old were you when he died?
I was 18. I was just getting set to go to college. I describe it in the book a little bit where I lived in a small town in California and had applied to colleges on my own. My mother had made it really, really clear to me that she thought that the local JC junior college was good enough for me. She wasn't going to pay for a private college or to send me off. And it happened to be that summer my grandfather died. And, you know, he made provisions for me to go to college. And I was very, very thankful.
Tell us about the reaction you've gotten since publishing Heart of a Tiger. Do people seem open to the idea that Ty Cobb had a softer side?
Well, the people who talked to me about it, yes. I'm certain that there are people who would say, "Wow, I never suspected that." I've read stories, but you know, in all truthfulness, I didn't write the book to push back on those stories. I mean, I've read about those stories, and people are going to really believe what they want to believe. Al Stump took many of those stories and exaggerated them to create a character that he wanted to put into a movie that would be monetarily very, very beneficial to him. I mean, really, the book Cobb, the whole first chapter, is like, wow, this guy must have been really, really something. Well, Mr. Bayshore, in reality, Ty Cobb, when that first chapter is supposed to have taken place at Lake Tahoe, was 73 years old. He was within 9 months of dying of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, liver problems. He used a cane to walk. He had refused for several years to drive his own car any distances at all. And Stump misdescribes the cabin at Lake Tahoe. He misdescribes several features about the cabin that would make it impossible to visit in the wintertime because it's on a very, very downslope toward Lake Tahoe. So once you drive your car down there, you can't get out. In other words, I don't think it really happened. But if I meet somebody who wants to say, wow, that was quite a movie, I'm not going to argue. They can believe what they want to believe. Urban myth is established, I don't think that people go out of their way to say, well, maybe that's a little bit exaggerated. But Stump did a lot to craft the person that he wanted to present, and I don't think that that was a very accurate portrayal of Ty Cobb, either as a historical figure or as a person. But my book was really intended to say something else. I mean, most people come up and say, Herschel, that I read that book, you had a tough childhood, but the parts about your grandfather were fascinating. Let me tell you about my grandparents. And it's been wonderful because their outpouring is just very, very generous. And I've heard several stories that have grandparents that were really personally much more interesting than anything that I wrote. And their stories are fascinating. And it's been a great way to get to know people in a way that really transcends cocktail conversation or lunchtime conversation and really means something to me and to them.
Herschel Cobb Jr. is the author of Heart of a Tiger, Growing Up with My Grandfather, Ty Cobb. Thank you, Mr. Cobb. Good luck.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
It's Current State on WKAR. The decline of Detroit is the focus of the documentary film Detropia. WKAR-TV airs the movie tonight at 10. Our Scott Pohl talked with Heidi Ewing, the co-director of Detropia, starting with what the title means.
Well, we were looking for a title for the film, and we tried hundreds and hundreds of titles. The original title of the movie was Detroit Hustles Harder, which we had started 3 years ago with that concept, and then the film changed and evolved, and that was no longer an appropriate title for the movie. And so we were thinking and just keeping our minds open, and there's a shot in the film of an auto parts shop that has been shuttered, and an artist has come in and changed the words auto parts to read Utopia. And it's a shot in the film, a guy walks by this auto parts store. And I just started playing around with Utopia and Detroit. And really, it is a combination of the word Detroit and Utopia. Because to many, especially during the Great Migration and people coming up from the South, Detroit really represented an economic utopia, an opportunity, and the beginnings of a real middle class, especially a black middle class. So, some would say that Detroit has fallen into a dystopian situation, but many believe that it really can be jump-started and rebooted to once again live up to its initial promise.
There's a powerful image in Detropia. It's actually visited a couple of times of a man and a woman wearing gas masks. Can you tell me where that came from?
Well, actually, there's a lot of artists that are moving to the city of Detroit, and we present two of them in the film.
Looked at Baltimore, we were looking into New York City, and Detroit came up. We can experiment here.
So a husband and wife who do performance art, and they do installations, and they do murals. And some of their persona and some of the performance art they do involves them in gold gas masks. And if you ask them, they would say they represent sort of the pitfalls of corporate America, and they have their own theories about why they put the masks on. But it's a very arresting image, and so we followed them for a year, and there's several scenes with them in the movie, and that's where the image comes from.
In a way, it's one of the most positive images in the movie because it depicts two artists who have chosen Detroit on purpose. They moved to Detroit because it's less expensive than other cities they considered relocating to. It's the one thing in the whole movie that has people choosing Detroit for a positive reason.
Actually, I would argue with that assessment, because if you look at all of the main characters in our film, including Crystal, George, and Mistress Tommy Stevens, the subtext, of course, is that all of those individuals have the resources to leave Detroit. They don't have to be there, and they choose to stay. And Mr. Stevens chooses to keep the Raven nightclub open, and George McGregor chooses to continue at the Union, even though he could walk away with a pension. Crystal Starr is a smart 20-something Detroiter who clearly has the, you know, wherewithal, brains, and ambition to leave if she chose to. So for me, actually, all of the subjects in the film represent the can-do spirit of Detroit, because they don't have to live there. And so while we don't come out and say it explicitly with all of the characters, that is something that is true about all of them.
I'll give you that point. I was only referring to people from outside Detroit choosing Detroit, the sort of thing that people might think Detroit needs, outsiders
right.
to choose Detroit.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, the artists in the film represent this sort of this community of newcomers that, like you say, are choosing to move to the city and relocate there. It's not just, they don't just come for the cheap real estate. I mean, they also come for, you know, the excitement, the romance, the nostalgia. There's sort of the hip factor that Detroit has, you know, taken on among young people. In some ways, the economic crises, in this very twisted way, the national recession is helping Detroit in some ways, because a lot of young people that would have chosen to move to, you know, New York or L.A. or San Francisco, are choosing Detroit because it's more affordable. So I think Detroit in some ways is benefiting a lot from, you know, the economic factors that kids coming out of college are facing. So it's kind of an interesting twist.
Detropia came out a year or so ago. Can you tell me whether you have stayed in touch with any of these people? Are things looking up for some or all of these people?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in touch all the time with all the subjects, actually. We, you know, talk very often. I talked to George and Tommy yesterday and Crystal last week, and we're always in touch. And, you know, I think that they would say that, in a modest way, they would all say that they've seen some improvements in Detroit since the movie came out. You know, I think the national reporting on the city is definitely so extreme. It's either, you know, about to go bankrupt and is the worst place to live in the world, or it's the comeback city. And I think that, you know, most Detroiters are weary of those interpretations, and including the subjects in our film, I think they would say they've seen some you know, moderate uplift since the film came out. Of course, since the film came out, the city has been pretty much taken over by a financial manager, so there's obviously a long road ahead. But I definitely sense a more of an optimism, and that the uptick in the auto industry did start happening at the very end of our time in Detroit. And in fact, actually, after Sundance, I went back and we included a scene to reflect that uptick, because it had just started and our film was finished. So, yeah, I think there's definitely more optimism in the city now than there was then.
There are people in Detroit who have wearied of images of Detroit, the decaying buildings, shut down factories, and so on. They often use the phrase ruin porn to describe that kind of depiction of Detroit. Did you face criticism along that line with Detropia?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that Detroiters are very, very sensitive about how their city is portrayed. But actually, I think from my experience in bringing the film to Detroit, I think people were very, very concerned that that's what the film was going to be. And most people, upon having seen it, feel differently, feel that it's there's a tenderness and there's, you know, there's a lot of love being shown to the city in our film. And we were pretty careful not to, you know, overdo it with just abandoned buildings. Most of the shots in our film have people in the shots because, you know, Detroiters interact with these spaces every single day, and they're sick of the spaces or they're curious about the spaces. I mean, they have their own relationship with these abandoned buildings and with the past. So we tried to reflect that with sensitivity in the film. To make a film about Detroit and not include any of those images is also, you know, bad reporting, because that is one of the top things that the city is trying to deal with. And every single day, the administration of the city and the people are discussing what to do with the vast tracts of land, with the uninhabited structures. I mean, it's sort of front and center right now in the city of Detroit, and its future really depends on, in so many ways, how that is resolved. So you have to include it, but you try not to fetishize it. And I believe that, you know, I hope we succeeded in that.
I was going to ask you if you think Detropia had the impact you had hoped for and what it means to have it on television with PBS bringing it to independent lens.
You know, every film you make, really, the impact is so hard to measure because it's over time. You know, people discover a film at different times and teachers start using it when they discover it. And, you know, it's we've seen with all of our movies, it's never over, you know. People come across these movies when they come across them. Some saw it in the movie theater. I mean, it played in 107 cities. Other people have, many people have seen it on Netflix. Some universities have already started showing it. I mean, PBS will open up. Millions and millions of viewers will see this film. So, you know, it's one of those sort of, it's always a moving target. There's international interest in the city of Detroit. The country is intensely interested right now in what becomes of this really sacred city, this mythical place, at least in the American imagination. People care about what happens to Detroit, and the discussion will continue for many, many years. And so for us, this is our, you know, cinematic contribution to that conversation, and it's not the whole story. It's our story. It's what we found. It's in some ways a meditation, in some ways a poem. So, you know, yes, it is having an impact and will continue to have an impact in ways that I can't even imagine. So it's not really up to the filmmaker anymore, and we've learned over the years to accept that and just sort of see what happens. You know, you make the film, you put everything you have into it, and then it really finds its own home and its own life, and people use it the way they want to. So I'm sort of watching that from the sidelines at this point. You know, we made a choice to work with PBS a long time ago in production on the film because we wanted the film to be free when it broadcast and not on subscriber television. And we wanted the film to have no commercials when people watched it. And we wanted to have editorial control of the film and not have somebody cut it down or change it. And all of those things were true with PBS, with Independent Lens. It was a way for us to protect our work and to share it with as many people as possible upon broadcast. And so we're really, really excited about it.
So what's next for you and your partners at Loki Films?
Well, we are actually in post-production on a documentary for ESPN about the glass ceiling for elite female athletes across all the different sports. And our film will air on ESPN August 20th. And we have Mary Lou Retton and Chris Evert and Lolo Jones and Lisa Leslie and all these amazing women across all these disciplines sort of talking about, you know, what happened to them once they hit the top of their sport. And it's really interesting sort of first-person anecdotes from some of the most fascinating people in sports. So we're excited about that. And we have a lot of other things in development that are going to be coming down the pike in the next couple of years.
Heidi Ewing is co-director and co-producer of Detropia, coming up on PBS. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Thanks very much for joining us today. For Current State, I'm Mark Bayshore.